Welcome back to Tipsy Theology. This is episode 21, and according to the physician Duncan McDougall, the weight of a human soul is 21 grams.
Interesting.
So what he did was he calculated the weight of a person before and after their death and came up with 21 grams. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah.
Well, either way, this is episode 21, and if episodes were years, we could legally drink.
You could finally.
Cheers to that.
Finally, you're able to imbibe.
You're right.
Appropriately.
Well, hey, today I wrote it down so I didn't forget anything.
Okay. Well, okay. That's
today we're going to be talking about art and faith with Dr. Daryl Ward, former public school educator and administrator who studies and writes and sometimes talks.
Yes, sometimes.
About creativity, the creative act, and how storytelling makes us better humans.
Yeah.
That's a great little intro. I love that.
I wrote it.
I know. Right?
So, of course.
Just a little, a little example of your skills.
Yeah. I'm going to do my best. But yeah, thanks for having me. Yeah, it's been a long time coming. We've talked for a few months now. We met you guys and hey, let's get together sometime. Had to clear a few things, which we did. And so
we waited the storm and
we did. So
yeah, there was a few times where it was like, oh, cool. We can have you on now. And you're like, hey, let's wait a little bit longer.
Like, yeah.
Oh,
yeah. So
you're teasing us.
Yeah. Well, I hope it's worth it, but it's been a long time coming. I'm excited to be here. So
yeah, it's great having you. And I think just starting off, you might be our favorite or best guest.
Yeah, because I brought all the booze.
You did.
So
you did all the heavy lifting.
For years, I used to do training for public school educators, and I liked it, but I never really felt I was doing very good at it, and I wanted to quit. And one of the head ladies like, no, you can't quit. We always get such great reviews. And I said, that's because I feed them and let them go early. Yeah. Of course they give me good reviews. It has nothing to do with my
competency. It's a give and take relationship,
It's not anything like that. So, but yeah, I have a little maker's mark. I thought that was appropriate.
Perfect.
Because we're talking about the maker and his mark on us. And so we'll share that. So, as I shared earlier before we went on the air, the interesting thing about this is, I don't really drink bourbon. So this might be a really interesting podcast. First of all, I'm not sure I can get the lid off.
I think, is that a cork?
If it's a cork.
Or is that a twisty boy? I know sometimes they switch it up with makers.
A little cork.
There, oh, sweet.
So, the audience can't see, but we have a little round,
it does my soul good to see these beautiful rocks.
Yeah, that's nice. And so
we've got these great swan. Are these handmade?
I believe so. I picked them up at Scout and Tag here locally in Lakeland. Great store.
Oh, yeah.
And so that was cool.
We've got nice little swans on it,
too. Yeah, swan. So cheers. All right. I've been told by my son, who is a bourbon aficionado, sip, Dad. Don't gulp.
So. Sip it.
Good stuff, right?
That is good. I like that. What are your thoughts as a, I guess,
as a non-bourbon,
non-bourbon drinker?
It burns.
It's a good burn, right?
I'm more of a craft beer guy.
Yeah.
So it burns. But it's an interesting story, this 46, without getting into too much detail. When I went to the distillery tour and they're telling you, they're selling stuff, right? That's what they're doing. But they're telling their stories. And the guy was trying to explain how basically bourbon, it's wood, that flavors it. In this instance, they took oak barrels and put different combinations of burnt wood in the oak, in the bourbon.
Yeah, yeah.
To get a flavor. And this one is called 46 because that was the 46th variation of the oak staves. And it was the one that the owner liked. And so here we go.
I think there's like 46 different burnt woods in it.
Yeah. No, I think there's only seven. But
that's cool.
It's got a nice little rich caramelly flavor to it. It's not bad.
It kind of adds a lot to just the normal maker's mark flavor, which I still enjoy, but it is like a more basic
bourbon, right?
Bourbon,
compared to some of the fancier ones. Yeah, the
exactly.
Buffalo Trace ones and all that. Yeah.
And this kind of adds like a level of complexity, which makes it more fun to sip, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it'll be good. So there we go. And we have, we have some beer as a backup. I bought some Coppertail Brewing Unholy because I think Belgian triple Unholy would be great to talk
about. That's one of Trey and I's favorites.
It's a serious beer with its alcohol content, so you have to be careful with that one. But it tastes great. It is good beer. So we'll see.
It is a bit unholy, I'll say
it. It is that.
The one thing I love about that, and I said it the one episode we had it on, is the artwork is amazing.
Yes,
on it.
There.
It's so good.
And if you ever get a chance to go, if you haven't, to over the brewery over in Tampa, near IKEA, so that helps everybody.
Okay, sweet. So you can build a build a cabinet while you're.
You should probably do it after you go. I don't know, before.
Have a
after,
celebratory
after,
beer.
Near, yeah, I survived IKEA. Let's go to the brewery. Right. That's what I do with my wife. You're like, I need to go to IKEA. All right, but I'm going to Coppertail. That's you're what right. I tell her. Because, but they have great artwork in there. You'd really like it. It's a great,
great
brewery, great tasting room, and so forth. But yeah, one of Tampa's, you know, Tampa has some super craft brewers, and that's a great.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Because I know I've been to Cigar City, and that one's really good.
Cigar City is good.
Yeah.
They're very good.
And they've got good food, too. I was surprised by that.
Yeah. That's an upgrade recently for them. They didn't used to really have. They used to be on the food truck people, you know, like a lot of the brewers do. But yeah, they're really good. Cigar City is a good one.
So. That's cool. So let me ask before we jump into everything.
Yeah.
We like to ask this of our guests. What are your thoughts on alcohol? We know that we're drinking publicly too. I guess relatively publicly.
Yeah, I think that it's like a lot of things that are in the world. There's a moderation aspect to it. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of it. You know, I had some discussion with some people about what some people believe, many actually, is the biblical prohibition against drinking, which I personally, I grew up in the Baptist church, so that was prevalent, right?
Yeah.
You don't drink, you don't dance. Somehow those are connected, right? I don't know. And I didn't grow up drinking. And I didn't even drink in college. And ironically is not the right word. Interestingly, it had nothing to do with my spirituality at the time. It had more to do with the personal impact alcohol had on someone close to me. Caused me to say, I don't really want to do this.
Yeah.
I was great. My buddies loved me in college because I was like the designated driver. We go to clubs and bars. I'm like, yeah, I'll drive. I'm not drinking. You know, they're like, let's go, Daryl. You know, I was real popular because I didn't drink. But as an adult, you know, I kind of beer was never something I got into. And I had a really good friend who said, well, you need to try some really good German beer. And he was kind of he turned me into a beer snob. So it was pretty good. And I got into different craft beers. You know, but like I'm not a Mick Ultra guy. I'm not a Bud Light guy. I just can't. I can't really do. In fact, I don't really care for lagers too much at all for that reason. But yeah, I think that I think like everything, it can be abused, and I don't think it's. I mean, if you're drinking alcohol to escape, just like if you're smoking pot to escape, just like if you're watching pornography to escape. I mean, I'm not equating them except to say this attempt to escape reality.
Yeah.
Speaks to an underlying spiritual condition in a lot of cases, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I'm not saying that pornography by itself is good, or I mean, I don't mean that. I'm just saying that there's an instance where when I'm using worldly flesh things to escape whatever my reality is, that's a whole other podcast probably, but that's kind of how I look at that. I mean, honestly, so.
Yeah, that's great. And it sounds like you kind of enjoy it the same way I do as far as alcohol is. I enjoy the art of it. I enjoy I enjoy the flavor, which you don't hear many people say probably.
Right.
I know. Yeah. Some people drink beer because they like to get drunk. I just think it tastes good.
Yeah. Yeah. That does put you in the minority, but
it's true. It's very true.
Yeah. Even among beer people, it's like,
they're like, really?
I don't know. That's not why I drink. Yeah. Yeah. But I agree with you. I think I don't have a particularly, my wife has gotten me in the last several years and my son and daughter-in-law into developing a little bit better of a palate of a wine palate.
Oh,
right.
Okay.
I happened to go to Italy and have some amazing wine in Tuscany. I'm like, okay, it's kind of funny.
Flexing on us over
here.
Yeah,
well, no, here's what's funny about that. I don't know if the listeners feel the same way, but there's got to be some weird level or threshold, I would say, of palate development. Like, right. So here's what I mean. I have people all the time say, man, this is great barbecue. And I love barbecue.
Yeah.
And I eat the barbecue and I go to myself, this is really good barbecue. But I don't know if it's great. I can't tell the difference. I can tell the difference between good and awful.
Yeah.
But good and great, and I'm using barbecue as an example. I'm sorry. I don't have that much. It's just burnt meat with sauce on it. I mean, it's good. Yeah. I like it.
Yeah.
And so sometimes that's the same way for me with other kind of thing. And I'm not dissing anybody who has a refined taste, who can tell, yes, there's slight notes of oak and earthiness to it. Okay. It just tastes like wine to me. So, I that's my kind of troglodyteness. I'm coming back out. Just give me the wine kind of thing.
I'd love to have some.
Yeah. Right. But I am developing a little bit better. I mean, I can taste a little bit different. Part of my issue, without getting too personal, is I don't have a really good sense of smell. Mm. I just don't. And so my wife's like, how can you taste anything? And she's right. I mean, I can taste, but it's like that. It's like so that, especially with things like wine, right? That really inhibits it. So when I told you about the bourbon, when I was doing the tasting at the Maker's Mark, everybody's swirling around. I'm doing the same thing, going.
They're sniffing it.
Like, yeah, it smells like alcohol, right? I can tell that, but that's about it. That's as good as
it gets.
That's
funny. Yeah, I'm kind of on like this weird precipice where I probably think I know more than I really do as far as like palate goes. Mm-hmm. Because I'm the same way with food. It's like, do I like it or do I not like
it?
Yeah. If something is like very, very good, I can recognize like the artisan side of it.
Right.
Where it's like, yeah, the chef obviously knows what he's doing because this is very good.
But if you're like me.
But to be able to like pull it apart and like, no, I need like comparison.
Except maybe not in some things, right? It's just weird how it does that to you. Like for there, I grew up, my family was from the panhandle of Florida and they were oystermen. So I grew up eating oysters like popcorn. I didn't know people thought they were weird because I just ate them. So I have a really refined palate for oysters. I mean, I can tell you, I can't tell you where it's from necessarily. I mean, but I can really taste the differences in the oysters.
Wow.
Love Pacific Northwest oysters, grew up eating Gulf oysters.
Yeah.
And also, anyway.
Wow.
That in that area, for some reason, that palate has been honed. But in other areas, it just is like, yeah, it's good.
That's
barbecue.
Funny.
Yep, sure is.
Yeah, sure. It tastes good. I feel like that with cupcakes. My sister's a baker.
Right.
One of the things that she does, and she's kind of spoiled me because she's been baking for a long time. So we've gotten, the full range of practice.
Right.
Yeah, and then now like the very high quality. And so when I taste like anything store bought, I'm like, what is this?
No, that's a good point too. And I sort of sometimes feel that way about craft beers. Like you get some really good ones and you get used to those and you get some.
Yeah.
No, not real good.
Yeah. True.
So yeah, I get you. I'm with you.
But art and faith.
Yeah. I kind of feel like with that, Paul, it's that, there's a little bit, I should probably begin with that kind of like onion metaphor, right? Where you keep peeling back the layers, hoping you're going to get to the bottom or to the heart of the onion. And you can get to the heart of it, but by then you're like in tears because it's an onion. So you just quit.
Yeah.
Right. True. And I hope that when we talk about art and faith, that's not where we get to, I hope we can get to something, but it is a lot of layers.
Like, I'm sure David can just start chiseling, be like, I just chiseled what didn't look like David. Other people try the same thing, and it's like, I have a rubble.
Right. Yes. Now I've destroyed. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Famous thing. Right. He said, I basically chisel to let the art out, kind of thing, is what he was saying. He could see that. Right.
Yeah.
Artistic vision. If you start at the beginning for me, I think it's important to see that early on, God is a maker. Right. Mm. In the beginning, God created.
Yeah.
Right. And we don't dispute that. And I think the impulse to create, to make things, it's embedded in our very beings. One of the guys I read a lot about this is a modern artist named Makoto. They call him Mako Fujimura.
Oh, I think that sounds familiar.
Yeah, you probably heard of him.
Came with a book, didn't he?
Yep, he's got several books out. A recent one called Art and Faith, The Theology of Making.
Yes, yes.
What's cool about Mako is he's a gifted artist. It's abstract kind of art. He practices the ancient Japanese art of, and I think I'm saying it right, Nihinga, Nihinga, Nihinga.
Okay.
And what it is you make your own paint, which first of all, from a non-painter blows my mind, right? Because I go to Sherwin-Williams and this guy's making his paint, right?
Wow.
And in the paint, you put crushed up minerals from traditional, literally centuries old recipes.
Wow.
And you paint with that. And so his work has this almost glowing iridescent quality.
Wow.
It's phenomenal stuff.
Yeah.
It's very abstract and all that. He had a studio near Ground Zero and was really impacted by 9/11 and all of that stuff. So gifted artist, gifted writer and speaker, especially about making and theology. And he talks about the fact that God communicates to us first as an artist, then as a lecturer. In the beginning, God created and he made all these things.
Okay.
And I think it's also interesting. I was doing some reading for this podcast that, in Exodus, when God is laying out the plans for building his house, the Ark.
Yeah.
Where are you going to live? I'm going to live in the Ark of the Covenant. He talks to two craftsmen.
Mm.
And I've got their names here. I want to get them right. One is Bezalel.
Okay.
And then Oholiab. Now, here's what's interesting. Let me read to you what it says from Exodus.
Yeah.
He fills them with, quote, quoting from scripture here, with the spirit of God, with wisdom, with understanding, with knowledge, and with all kinds of skills.
Hmm.
So Mako makes the point, never thought of this, the first, arguably, the first people in the Bible with the Holy Spirit were artisans.
Hmm.
That's they're the first record that we have recorded that it says we're filled with the Spirit of God.
Wow.
So, you know, I think that's an important kind of establishment about God, the maker, God, the creator. And I also think that sometimes art and faith oddly kind of seems to be at odds with one another, right? People have, you know, right? They have strong kind of things. And I don't want to get too deep into reading stuff, but I think it's really important. Again, from Mako, he writes, imagination like art has often been seen as suspect by some Christians who perceive the art world as an assault on traditional values. These expectations of art are largely driven by fear that art will lead us away from truth into an anarchic freedom of expression. Yet after many decades of the church proclaiming truth, we are no closer as a culture to truth and beauty than we were a century ago.
Wow.
All right. I mean,
dang.
It's profound and insightful and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So it becomes this debate, right? How do you reconcile art and faith, which I think is kind of the main topic of what we're talking about today.
And it's kind of funny because that makes me laugh. I think for for reasons we can, even looking at that, it's like when we see the temple being built, it's like it was a beautiful, you know, he went to excellent people in their craft, very skilled people, and they built a masterpiece.
Right.
And we see even now, it's like, you know, we look at old churches like, oh, these things are masterpieces. It's like, yes, of course.
Right.
We look at old, you know, religious art, we label it now. It's like, they're beautiful. People study them for years.
Yeah.
And now we call, that's Christian art.
Yeah.
That's art.
Right.
It's like, there's this huge dichotomy now that's been created where it's like, why has that been created?
Yeah. And interestingly, right, if you study some of the old Christian artists who created those buildings, they weren't necessarily Christian.
Right.
I mean, they were getting paid to do a job.
They were just commissioned by the church.
Right. Right. That was the only thing that made them that. And so that's an interesting thing. And I think what you hit upon there, Paul, for me is this aspect of beauty, right?
Hmm.
I say all the time, God didn't have to make beauty. He didn't have to. He's making the world how he wants. He didn't have to make, didn't have to make the rainbow look like it looked.
Yeah.
He didn't have to make the world look like it. He didn't have to make beauty, nor did he have to somehow put in us this ability to recognize beauty.
Yeah.
It's hard to define, right? But we know beauty. We see beauty. Okay, that's beautiful, right? We get that. But God didn't have to do that, yet he did.
Yeah.
So there must be something that God wants us to do with beauty, recognize, create, and so forth with it. And I it's interesting, too, because And again, in prep for the show, I was doing some reading and there's a great story or an interesting story to me, and I think you'll enjoy as well, about John Calvin. Okay. Mm. Right. Foremost theologian, Protestant theologian. And Calvin, you know, he formulates his theology, right? Which, you know, tulip, all that stuff. And he starts off with the big one, right? Total depravity.
Right?
You know, it's
a big phrase.
That's a big one, right? It basically means what? Man is scum. Nothing man can do.
Yeah.
Right? He's depraved, which is a serious word. But here's what's interesting. Calvin believed that, but he had this weird kind of cognitive dissonance going on. And maybe some of the listeners, maybe you don't know this. Before he was a quote unquote theologian, he was a lawyer. He studied law.
Oh, wow.
And he was really enamored by some of the Greco-Roman writers, especially Seneca. And they were pagan as all get out. And he knew that. But he was blown away by their truth-telling, by their writing. And so he had this weird kind of, how do I justify their pagans? Wow. But they have this beautiful work. And so Calvin himself kind of came up with what a lot of us do. He has this compromise. He has this loophole. You know, it's like the W.C. Fields, you know, the old comedian.
I'm not familiar.
Okay. He's an old 40s, 50s comedian. Maybe some of the listeners, they're podcast listeners. They won't know who he is. I have to look up W.C. Fields. He was one of
those. Pause it and look it up.
Yeah. He was one of those wisecracking, hey, how you doing, kind of comedians. And
yeah,
he was on his deathbed and someone came to visit him. And he's reading a Bible and they said, W.C., I didn't know you were a believer. And he goes, I'm not. I'm looking for loopholes. Right. And so here's Calvin looking for a loophole. And this is what he comes up with. And this is Calvin's quote, right? He says that God provided, quote, natural gifts that are bestowed indiscriminately upon the pious and the impious.
Hmm.
And he called these gifts a peculiar grace. Keep that phrase in mind, peculiar grace. He even went further to say that when we see something created by an unbeliever, that we should neither reject the truth of it nor despise it wherever it shall appear unless we wish to dishonor the Spirit of God. So he has this kind of, again, loophole. Okay.
Yeah,
they're pagans. Yeah, they're unbelievers, but they created this amazing art. That obviously God gave them the ability to do, whether they know it or not, which is really interesting. Now, go a little further. There's another theologian, a guy named Abraham Kuyper, K-U-Y-P-E-R, right? And Kuyper he's a Calvinist, big time Calvinist. He takes Calvin's peculiar grace and he just ramps it up a little bit and he calls it common grace.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And he distinguishes common grace and saving grace and that sort of thing. But he basically says that common grace is this whole ability that God gives specific gifts to people. Right. The rain falling on the just and the unjust.
Yeah. Yeah.
The pious and the impious. And that's how it operates mysteriously. You know, he makes a quick distinction. Right. He would say something like common grace allows Picasso to create. Common grace doesn't cause Picasso to be a believer, right? That's a saving grace thing.
Yeah.
So he tries to make that distinction, and I've got his two volumes on it, which are, I don't know, I'm not making this up. They're literally like 900 pages of his writings. So I'm working my way through.
Really making it work.
Yeah, I'm working my way through that. But he believes, you know, Kuyper believed that God cared about art and education and athletics and politics and all those things because everything for his glory. So that's an interesting way to think about reconciling art or politics, right? Any of those things in faith, I think.
Yeah, you know, you had me thinking too, call back to the barbecue. It's like, you know, it takes just about anybody to recognize good versus bad barbecue. Mm-hmm. We'll go with that same example.
Right.
But it takes a skilled craftsman to say, this is why it's good.
Yes. Yeah, agreed.
And I think in this sense, I think inherently people can recognize beauty.
Right. I would
because
agree.
God creates systems and we're a product of that system.
Right. Sure.
And part of our design is to recognize what is good and what is not.
Right. Yeah. And yeah, I think you could take that one step further and say, sure, there's an element of finesse or craftsmanship that perhaps the naked eye doesn't tell, so to speak. Mm-hmm. When I was working on my PhD dissertation, I was interviewing a lady and she was telling me about her father who used to be, this wasn't his vocation, but kind of, I guess, as a hobby or whatever, he was a woodworker and he would make cabinets and furniture. And she described this great story of one time she watched him and he's making this drawer and he's using these fine dovetailed corners, which are intricate woodwork where you cut out the piece of one edge and you cut out the piece of the other edge and they fit perfectly, right? They're dovetailed.
Yeah.
And nobody's ever going to see that. Right. And that's an attention to craftsmanship and detail. Why? Because it's about glorifying God. It's about glorifying the creator who gave him this ability. Yeah. Nobody's going to look at the back of my drawer and say, wow, that's finely made.
Yeah.
Except the person that made it.
Yeah.
And except God. They know. And so there's that attention to craftsmanship, artisanship, that there is a distinction between good and great. We were joking about barbecue.
Yeah.
Not everybody knows it. All right. I can't necessarily, even with art. One of my things that I get a kick out of, you know, my background artistically was my degrees in creative writing. So I know a little about writing. I do that. And I taught high school English. So I know all that kind of stuff. I've gotten into fine art photography. We'll talk about a little bit later. But one thing that is not my thing, as much as I enjoy it, is music. I don't really know music. So when I was the administrator at a performing arts high school, it was interesting because I didn't know music. And I could say something sounded good, but then
my boss at the time, he would say, do you hear of this? Blah, blah, blah. Do you hear what they're doing? And I'm like, no. Right. Because again, he had a finely tuned artisan's ear toward what made something musical.
Yeah.
And he would say, everybody has the same notes, but not everybody plays it the same way.
Yeah.
Right. And we know that. And I know that, you know, cognitively.
Sure.
But being able to hear that with my ear, I just don't have that refinement. But yet many people do. So I also recognize there is that level of understanding between good and great. You're sure that people have. Not everybody has that. I mean, totally get that.
Yeah, it's a whole nother level of everything. But to what you're saying too, it's like it is amazing that when it comes to this idea of common grace,
right?
That, you know, under that doctrine, I guess we can call it that.
Yeah, I think that. Yeah, that's that fair. Belief, that theology. Yeah,
yeah. Where it's like that does make sense for what it, for the background and context of what he's saying.
Yeah, and I think he goes at it. You know, and I have to still do more research on his scriptural, because he comes at it from scripture, and I don't know that real well. But I think his main argument, Kuyper, would be that nothing man did in the fall ruined God's appreciation for his creation. Right? He didn't, because man sinned, suddenly the earth wasn't not beautiful, right?
Yeah.
And that kind of thing, right? Yeah. Or whatever. And so Kuyper kind of looks at that and goes, so there's a reason that this beauty is here. There's a reason these people have these gifts, sometimes even if they don't understand those gifts. So I think that's an interesting, I don't know enough about it to drive the stake in the ground on it, but it is interesting about the idea of commonness and that there are these gifts that people have been given.
Yeah.
That ultimately are to glorify God, maybe even if they don't know they are, which is really kind of interesting.
Yeah. I think that's what's kind of funny. It's like, I'm trying to think of a good example. I'm thinking even people growing up where it's like my parents were used to go to a church where they learned some amazing things about God, and they were taught some incredible things from someone who ended up not even proclaiming to be a believer.
Yeah.
And it's like, how does that happen?
Well, yeah. My wife tells a great story about when she went to a secular state university, but she took Old New Testament at a secular university. And her New Testament class was taught by a Jewish person who presumably didn't believe anything in it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And her Old Testament was taught by a Christian. And she makes a strong argument that they taught her a lot because of and I think it's because of the perspective that they bring to it, right? It's all about the perspective.
They can add a lot.
And so that's an interesting kind of thing too, right? That you can learn from people, even though, you know, and I mean, hesitant to say they're being used as puppets by God. You know, that's a different kind of thing.
Right.
But obviously that God's using things to glorify him. And that may be even gifts that people have that they don't recognize us what they're doing with.
Yeah. And I know I bring that back to my favorite phrase that everyone familiar with the show knows. Is truth is truth is truth. So it's like the pursuit of excellence leads you to the beauty of who Christ is.
Right. Absolutely.
And yeah. That's what I see with that. It's like, no matter what your personal beliefs are, if you're adamantly and religiously pursuing your craft,
right,
whether that's speaking, whether that's art, whether that's music, engineering, whatever it may be, there's a level of that reflects who Christ is because there's truth in that.
And I agree with you. And I think for me, I've done a lot of thinking on this, not only in preparation for the show, but in fairness to some of that. And when I try, how do you reconcile art and faith? You know, you're an artist. What do you think, Daryl? So let me throw some things out here that may be a little bit radical. Maybe not. Maybe I'm making up. Maybe I'm creating my own theology, Paul. I don't know.
Those are our favorites.
I'm amazed by how often in scripture God does things with the sole purpose of this. Pay attention.
Yeah.
Right? So, I mean, I've got some examples. He takes Moses up to Mount Ararat, give him the Ten Commandments, and what does he tell him? Hey, write this down.
Yeah.
Pay attention. He tells the Israelites later, talk about them when you sit at home, when you walk along the road, when you lie down, when you get up, tie them as symbols on your hands, you know, phylacteries, right? Mm-hmm. Bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your house and your gates. Mm. Why? Pay attention.
Yeah.
In the New Testament, Jesus says what? Consider the lilies of the field.
Hmm.
Pay attention. Pay attention to the lilies.
Yeah.
He also shares, he who has ears, let him hear.
Hmm.
Pay attention. And you know, what about the parable, you know, the 10 virgins, when he says, keep watch because you don't know when the day and the hour of his return is going to be. That's a clear call to
better pay attention.
Pay attention. Right? You're catching on here. And my this is my favorite story in the whole Bible. I got a couple of them, but this is one of my favorites. And the parable of the Good Samaritan. Everybody knows it. Christians and non-Christians, you know, many people from different faiths know the Good Samaritan. And I love the story, the way it kind of breaks down these layers. But remember that scenario, right? The expert in the law comes up to him. How do you get eternal life? Jesus tells them, and he goes, hey, well, I've done all those things. And then you love your neighbor. And then he should have quit there. Right? Yeah. If you know the
story.
He was ahead. He'd done all these things. Jesus is like, okay, man, you got it. And then he says, oh, and who is my neighbor? And Jesus then lays out the parable of the Good Samaritan, which really says, hey, look around.
Yeah.
Everyone's your neighbor.
Yeah.
Pay attention. And so this idea of the of God trying to get us to pay attention really resonates with me as it relates to making art, because I think that's a key to making art, is to pay attention.
Yeah.
And whether you're a writer, you're a filmmaker, you're a photographer, whatever you're doing, it's about paying attention to the world around you. I think one of the most important aspects of the divine intervention is to get us to see the things that really matter, right? To look at the world around us and to see the different things that we need to see. I would argue that pedagogically in the New Testament, Jesus's main purpose was to teach us to see with different eyes, not religious eyes, not political eyes, not socio-cultural eyes, but with the eyes of God and how he sees his people. And so if that's the theological background as an artist, then I think art does the same thing. Art says, look around.
Yeah.
Look at the people. Look at their joy. Look at their pain. Look at their look at the injustice. Look at the glory. That's what art does. And so I think that's a reconciliation of art and faith, a strong one in my opinion.
Yeah, you know, I heard someone recently say, I don't know who it is to give them any credit for it. I don't remember. I think it was a pastor who was saying, it's funny how they can go up and speak for 40 minutes, and yet you have this 3-minute song that speaks the same message in a way that engages people like he wasn't able to.
Correct. Yes. And I think that's the power of art speaking to us. And again, I believe, as we said,
because it speaks on more than a cognitive level.
Right. There's an emotional connection. There is a cognitive connection, but there's an emotional connection. And then there's this weird kind of resonance, right? It just vibrates on our inner being when we see something that's like that. And so that idea of art, you know, to your point, I heard someone talk about, you know, the art should make us uncomfortable. And I kind of go, you know, there's nothing wrong with art that makes us uncomfortable. There's a purpose for that. But I don't, you got to be careful. And I would say this about anything I'm saying as well, is putting something as broad as God, as theology, and as art making in a simple box, right? So that all art should make us uncomfortable. I don't know. Norman Rockwell does not make me uncomfortable.
It makes me feel kind of warm and fuzzy.
Yes, which was kind of his point.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and so I think there's something to be said for that. And I know as an artist myself, it's that speaking back to the world through a particular medium.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's really about slowing down, looking around, seeing things you might, because you might also make us, you know, and this is a little going out a little bit, but you might also make a strong argument that if the primary objective of God is to get us to pay attention, the primary objective of the fallen world is to get us to be distracted. Right. And to not pay attention to what God wants us to pay attention to. And I'm not going off on some weird, you know, anti-iPhone rant or whatever, right? I mean,
I think that's a pretty fair idea though. I mean, you think about it, even when we take the message of the gospel, it's like ignoring the message itself, which is very important, but it's like, why do we go and speak to other people? Well, because it's important and we want them to pay attention to it.
Yeah, right.
To your point.
Yeah.
And in the same way, it's like, you know, why do you tell a disturbing story? Because you want people to pay attention to whatever disturbing point you're trying to make. I
totally agree.
Why are you trying to tell a nostalgic story? Because you want to point people back to the importance of past, the importance of comfort.
Yeah, and I also think, Paul, I don't know that it always has to be some deep
No, not
meaning,
at all.
Right? I mean, it can
sometimes,
be.
So, I mean, I think of Paul Simon in this. Yeah. It's like people look at what's like the, why can't I think of the, Hello Darkness, My Old Friend. What's the name of that song?
Old
Simon and Garfunkel song.
Yeah, Hello Darkness, My Old Friend. Yeah. Why are we blanking on that?
Everyone's yelling at me now. Yeah, they're screaming at their dashboards like, of course, this is the name of the song.
Yes. Yeah.
But we know which song I'm talking about.
We do. Well, I do, yeah.
So with that, you know, people were sitting there like,
I keep wanting to say Bridge Over Troubled Waters, but that's not it.
That's a different one.
It's a different Paul Simon song.
Oh my gosh, this is going to bother me the entire episode.
Yeah, I know.
We'll get there. But that line in particular, Hello Darkness, My Old Friend, everyone's sitting there like, what does this mean? Like, it must be something with like depression or him struggling with his shadow and all this. And he's like, no, actually, you know, when I was young, I used to sit in the bathroom because it was quiet and I'd play music in there.
Yeah,
and,
right.
And for him, it's like, it's just a song. It doesn't mean anything.
Exactly.
And it's I've like heard maybe meaning out of it, but he was just making music.
I've heard similar things. I don't know if they're true about the Beatles and Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, LSD. You know, they're like, no, that's really not it at all.
He's like, I just saw a drawing from my 5-year-old.
Yeah, it looked like it was a good idea.
Yeah.
And so I think there's that kind of element of art making. But I still go back to, you know, artists really, try and make us pay attention and that kind of thing. And I know in my own, art making, especially photography, that's what I want. I'm gonna share a couple things with you. So I just got back from Utah, which is an amazing landscape, and it was specifically with a buddy of mine to do photography.
Mm.
And so I'm trying to practice what I preach here, right?
Yeah.
And not so as a photographer, when I'm trying to make art, I'm not just standing there snapping off a bunch of pictures. Now I do take a bunch of pictures, and admittedly, most of them aren't what we call keepers.
Sure.
But I'm trying to, the thing I love about it, you know, people talk to me about my photography is it makes me slow down and look.
Hmm.
So I want to show you a couple images. So
please.
I know the audience can't see them. Maybe we'll post them on Instagram. But what I'm showing Paul here is an image of Bryce Canyon of a lady who's come up through the canyon. And I'm on top and I'm focusing down through the canyon walls.
Hmm.
And she's coming up. And she's opened and she's just staring up at the massive canyon walls. I call it canyon wonder.
Hmm.
And this was me on top. And so when I'm taking this photograph, I'm purposely concentrating on the grandeur of the space.
Yeah.
I'm in this case using black and white because it's drawing out the focus on the lady who looks in the picture. You can visualize it when you're listening, like a tiny miniature person, right?
Yeah. Just in the tiny lower third of it.
Right.
Yeah.
But it also shows her looking up at the massiveness. So it communicates a lot of things I was feeling and seeing myself at this wonderful place, Bryce Canyon National Park in Utah.
That's so cool.
So, and then the next one is also out in Utah, and it's a twilight picture of a natural stone arch. But the thing that's interesting about this is, and again, Paul's looking at it here with me, it was taken at twilight, and so the rock that you can see here is actually in the dark. And what I did was, is I opened the exposure on the camera, and I took a flashlight, and I shined light on the dark rock so that when you get a finished picture, you can still tell it's night, right? But you can see.
You get the light from the...
You get the light from the flashlight lighting up the stone arch.
That's so cool.
Again, an idea for me of slowing down. Takes a while to make this type of picture.
Yeah.
In that respect, right? As well as learning to visualize and communicate to someone who's going to view it what my vision for the piece of art is. So
that's really cool.
Yeah, and it's something, so when I talk about art as causing us to slow down and to pay attention, I think that works really nicely with what I believe God's trying to get us to do through his indwelling and through his word as well, is to slow down and pay attention.
Yeah, I think that's a good message in there. Cause I think, even to the point where I feel like there's so many different ways we can pull it. Maybe that's one of the things that I found for myself is maybe it was just a habit I built while trying to get through school.
It's sure.
Like, I can BS my way through a lot of things.
Yeah.
But the one thing I always loved was analyzing art and kind of like trying to pull a more of a meaning out of it, whether it's actually there or not.
Yeah.
Totally irrelevant. But the one thing I do love, even looking at the art that you just shared with us too, is like, it is that idea of like, let's stop and let's slow down and just appreciate it. Let's take a moment away from our, knee-jerk reactions, and let's analyze those too.
Yeah, and I think I was thinking about something exactly similar to that, Paul, and I'm going to say it publicly, and then I'm going to probably contact him and see if he'll do it. I was thinking about getting with Dr. Alex Rich, the executive director of the Polk Museum of Art. Mm. I think it would be a cool art installation where you put art up in a museum, right?
Mm.
And you require they have to sign a waiver that every person that goes into the gallery, and maybe you put people there to monitor it, has to stand in front of the art for 3 minutes before moving on.
That's actually really cool. Right? Like
and I don't know what you'll see. I don't know what you'll get out of it. But to your point about slowing down and looking at it, we just don't do it. I mean, how many times have we been to, I've been blessed to be in some major museums in the world and you're just zipping through them, right? Mm. What's the number one objective in the Louvre? Get to the Mona Lisa with the 50,000 tourists that are there.
Hold your phone up high.
Yeah, right. Yep. Nobody stops and just looks at the Mona Lisa. Now, unfortunately, with the logistics, you can't really even do that now.
True.
But what if you had an exhibit of art, and it doesn't matter what the art is, where you're forced to slow down, just stop.
Yeah.
And not move. And then ding, bells look off, you go to the next piece. Yeah. I think that would be really interesting, especially to talk to the people, of course, right? Mm. This is my social science research coming up in me. Talk to them afterwards about the difference that experience was than maybe one of their traditions. Mm. And maybe they think they're a fan of art. Maybe they're an art, you know, they're an art buff or something.
Yeah.
And I guarantee you they don't go to an art museum. I don't. They don't go to an art museum and stand in front of each piece for 3 or 4 minutes.
Not at all. And I know for me, like, I'm a bit of a snob. So I think I'm very critical. I've definitely come to find. And
I'm gonna pour another round.
Oh, thank you. But the one thing that I do,
I don't think we're gonna get to the beer, by the way.
We might not.
No. we still got a half bottle.
And this is a great place to stop right here too, right on these guys. but I'll say for myself, you know, the one thing that I love is that moment when I'm walking through an art museum and I find that one piece that just captures my attention. I'm sure it's happened to you before.
Sure, yeah.
You're walking through, you're like, okay, yeah, everything's good, whatever. And it's like, what is that?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it draws you in. And the more you look at it, the more you appreciate it and the more you learn from it. And it would be an interesting exercise. I'm interested to do this for myself without signing a waiver. Even.
Yeah. Well, I like it's the like, electric I, shock thing.
Yeah, right.
You leave, you left early. Get back.
Everyone's wearing a little shock collar.
We got a whole new art exhibit.
Here's your
going
security
on
guard. Yeah. He's very strict.
Yes. If you leave, you're getting zapped.
yeah. You know, that would be an interesting exercise to do, to actually go and, you know, some of them are going to suck. Mm-hmm. And it's like, yeah, this wasn't worth my 3 minutes.
Absolutely. You're
but
right.
What did you learn from the ones that were worth 3 minutes?
Yeah. And to your point earlier about how something speaks to you, that's similar to the mystery of God. Is this sometimes that's a mystery thing. A recent example with me within the last few years, I didn't grow up in a particularly art centric house. Now, we appreciated country music, which I really appreciate. Good.
So not very art centric.
Yeah,
I get
not
that.
Very that's a whole other podcast on the artistry of country music. But and so I took a class in high school with a wonderful, amazing teacher. It was humanities class, right? Mm. And what's interesting is I would go to that. I was a senior, so I'm half paying attention anyway, right?
Yeah.
Senior high school. And she was one of those teachers that had just had art all over the walls and art all over her window. And right next to my desk where I happened to sit, that covered the window pane. So maybe it was, I don't know, 13 inches by 24 inches, was a reproduction of Botticelli's famous painting, The Birth of Venus. Okay, which everybody's seen, the clamshell lady, right?
Yeah,
everybody's
seen
that. And I went to school my senior year, and every day, so let's say roughly for 100, 150 days, 180, whatever it was, I sat next to the clamshell lady. And my teacher talked about art and all this kind of stuff. And I truly began to appreciate art, not necessarily The Birth of Venus by Botticelli, but whatever.
Yeah.
Now, fast forward, I'm ashamed to admit this, 40-something years, 35 years. About 2 years ago, I got a chance to go to Italy, and specifically to Florence and the Uffizi Gallery, where Botticelli's The Birth of Venus is. And I have to say, it's hard for me to even say right now, like getting emotional. I stood in front of that painting and I almost wept. It was just just the strange thing about now I get it. And it just totally resonates to your core. And yeah. I that's what art can do, right? Just like yeah. a well played piece of music and yeah. that sort of thing can do. And it's hard for me not to think that's not from God. Now, I don't always have proof of that, right?
Sure.
But it's hard for me not to think that that experience, which is kind of this sublime joy, an internal thing. You know, I wasn't in the Uffizi Gallery doing cartwheels, right? Now, I stood in front of that one for more than 3 minutes, right? And so to your point about what gets you, what resonates with you, you know, there's a lot of things that go into that, I think.
Yeah, it's really true. And I think that it reminds me of the first picture that you showed of the girl in the canyon above her. When we look at that, the one thing I like about that is there's actually a part of the canyon that juts out and blocks our view of what she's seeing.
Right. You're right.
And what kind of pulls me from that is like, wow, so it's showing two perspectives. Is one true? Is one wrong? I don't know. They're different.
Yeah, right.
And I think that's one of the interesting things when we view God. Multiple people will have different experiences that lead them to approaching God in a different way.
Right.
Sometimes I'll say right now, sometimes they are wrong.
No,
because there is a level of truth that's involved with everything.
Sure, I agree.
But there is something to be said for people experience God differently.
Right. Fair enough.
And that's, you know, in and of itself, that's not for us to negate from someone else. We can, you know, ask questions about that to see if there's validity to, is that really God? But yeah, you know, one painting speaks to someone differently because of their experience. Another painting speaks to someone differently because of their experience. If you didn't grow up viewing the clamshell lady,
right? Who knows?
It might not have hit you the same way.
I totally agree. And to your point about the grandeur of God's creation, you know, in natural and landscape and so forth, that's a really good point about how that hits people. And I don't want to suggest, nor are you, a pantheistic kind of approach of God, you know, worshiping the nature, whatever. But again, he didn't have to make it beautiful.
Right.
He didn't have to make it look like that. It could have just been a big dirt hole in the ground or something, and yet it isn't. And it does speak to people, and I think that's a really good thing. I'll tell this quick story.
Yeah.
I said I just got back from Utah, but I also, a few weeks before that, I took my mother out to California. She'd never been to the West Coast, so we took her out there to see the Pacific and the San Francisco and the Redwoods. We go to Yosemite National Park, and we're climbing Glacier Point Road, which is a famous road that kind of looks down on the valley with some magnificent views of Yosemite. And we come around a bend and you see Half Dome, which is this massive granite monolith. And the first time you see it, and my 80-year-old mom's response was, "Oh, wow." and it just it brought such joy to my heart.
Wow.
And I'm thinking, yes, mom, that's the appropriate response when you see that beauty. Oh, wow. You know? And that again, I think, speaks to God's artistry and what as the ultimate maker and what he, you know, how he chose to create things. It didn't have to look like that, right? Like I said, but yet it did because he's communicating with us even through that.
Yeah.
Even through beauty.
Yeah, it's true. I know, to go on a small tangent here. I'm more of a music guy too. That's a huge part of my background. And so to dive into that just briefly on a very like, it's a deep surface level, I'll say, without getting super musically technical. Christopher Small, he wrote a book. He was a music psychologist, or he was a music guy.
Yeah, gotcha.
He wrote a book called Musicking, The Meaning of Performance and Listening. And so one of the things he argued is like, music isn't a noun, it's a verb. Mm. It's something that we do. And so one of the quotes he has in there is, musicking is an activity by means of which we bring into existence a set of relationships that model the relationships of our world. So that's a very like scientific way of saying when it comes to music, when it comes to art, I'll make it very broad in that sense. It's a verb. It's something that we interact with, something that we do.
A way to experience.
Yeah.
It's a way to connect. There are a lot of ways to connect. You know, you made you were kidding earlier about a scientific science. There's a scientific way to connect to things, and there's nothing wrong with that. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
But art and aesthetics and beauty is another way to connect to the world. And in the making of art, in the making of music, for example, it's a way to, you know, the phrase that gets used all the time, it's a way to speak back to the world, right? This is what I see. And that's why when people ask me about my photography, I tend not to be a person that heavily edits in that. I don't want it to look too unlike what I saw. However, I'm also not a snapshot guy. I'm not trying to just provide you a journalistic thing of what I saw. So I do some editing. I do crop, and I don't heavily change colors or set whatever, but
it's a
I
way
do
of emphasizing.
But I have an artistic vision for the photo. All right. That's the difference. I would argue between, you know, taking snapshots, which again, it's not wrong. It's just taking snapshots versus trying to speak back to the world with an artistic vision, with a photographic vision. And I would argue, I guess, you know, to your music thing about, it's the same way about everyone could have Mozart's concerto in front of them, one of his concertos, but they don't all play it the same. Right. They speak back to the world in a different way through the way they play.
And I think that's the beauty of, I'll use the term musicking again. That's the beauty of it. It's like everyone does it differently. Some are better than others for sure.
Fair enough.
There's also a huge difference between who you're doing it with. You know, are you doing it by yourself? Like am I at home playing to myself, playing for myself? Am I with a small group of friends? Am I in front of a big group of people? You know, am I listening to a recording?
Yeah.
It's like those are all ways that we experience art that changes the experience.
And so let me take that and go down another tangent that I would say would be a little more controversial.
Yeah.
I personally believe everyone that makes art, and that's a broad thing, but we're just going to say it that way. Everyone that makes art, every person that makes art, I believe they do so as an act. I won't say conscious because I think sometimes it's not conscious.
Yeah.
But I think they make art as an act of legacy. I think they do it to make a mark on the world, to leave something, even if they will argue with you that that's not why they do it. I used to teach writing, right?
Yeah.
And there's a lot about write diaries and journaling and so forth. And I'm like, oh, I don't want anybody to read my journal. And I would argue, I disagree with you. You might not want anybody to read it now. But if you didn't want anybody to read it, you wouldn't write it down. Now, there's a strong school that argues against that. There's other reasons to write it down besides having someone to read it. Fair enough, blah, blah, blah. But I still maintain that everybody that creates art does so to try and scratch out a little bit of I was here.
I'm inclined to agree with you. And maybe it's because I've joked about this before. Maybe I'm a little bit more narcissistic than the average person.
And that's
right. I don't think I'm the only person that's had an internal dialogue of me on the Tonight Show talking about something I did.
Right. Like, here's why I came up with this. Well, and I think, and that's, you said the right word, right? Sometimes we don't want to admit that because it seems narcissistic.
Yeah.
But I actually think that goes to a deep kind of, again, God instilled thing in us about wanting to create something for posterity's sake. Now, most of us aren't naive enough to think that this picture I made of this woman in the canyon is going to be around 150 years from now.
Yeah.
I'm not. But I will admit that there's something about wanting people to see that, right? And for it to impact them in a way that's memorable. That leaves a mark, so to speak.
Yeah.
And I really, like I said, it's a little controversial because some artists would disagree with me, and that's okay. They're not here and they're not drinking bourbon. Be a big fight. Throw down in the Maximize Digital Studios.
Yeah, right. To be fair, I don't think most artists, I think most of them are pacifists.
Yeah,
though,
that's right. they wouldn't do that. But I think it really is kind of how we're wired. I think that art making, and you might even really stretch it to say that a lot of what we do as human beings is legacy driven.
I was actually just about to go down that path. And it's like, you know, what's the reason that we speak? Well, because we think we have something to say. We want what we have to say to impact others. And I think the same thing is for art. That's a way of us speaking in a way that's not the English language or whatever our native language is. It's a way of speaking in without words, in a sense.
I think it creates it, getting really deep and philosophical.
Yeah.
Because I've had a couple sips of bourbon now.
Yeah.
I think it speaks to this thing that we have inside us about railing into the void, right? That what God has called us to do matters.
Yeah.
That we matter as people, that we matter as humans, we matter as creators, we matter as artists. So I'm going to try and do something that yells into the void. I am here.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is what at this instant, this photo, whatever it is, right? This poem, this story, this movie, this is what life is like right now.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think
why do we so often see, you know, rocks with etches, you know, Daryl was here.
Yeah. Right.
We want people to know.
Yeah. And we kind of laugh at that, but yet we do the same thing in some other aspect of our lives.
Yeah.
I mean, how many people, you know, I hope I'm not one of them. I might be guilty of it. But how many people try and live out a legacy, their own legacy through their children?
Hmm.
Right. Because they want their existence to be meaningful.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's a heavy thing. Hmm. And it's usually not a positive thing, but I'm
not often. Yeah.
But it is. I think it's the same thing. I think it's this idea that what I, you know, my time here mattered.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of ways I can show you that. Maybe I'm political. Yeah. Maybe I'm political. Maybe, you know, teachers, of course, are, I think, at the top of that list, in my opinion, you know, doing things that matter that nobody pays attention to till forever later. Right.
Yeah.
But I think artists are the same way. They actually tend to be more, you know, kind of visible-ish, if you will, and it, I don't know if visible-ish is a word, but I'm an English teacher.
We'll go with it.
Don't try this at home. I'm a professional. Artists kind of get more notoriety for it because they're artists, but I think I think we all do it in some form or fashion, and art is one mechanism to do that, right? To kind of yell into the void, I matter. God made me, and here's what I can do to show you that I matter. I created this photo. I made this movie. I made this song, whatever it is, right?
Yeah. You're making me think of, I'm going to pull out my geeky side, my nerdy side. So I don't know if you're familiar with the show Doctor Who.
I thought that was already evident, Paul, but
darn
go
it.
Ahead.
I thought I was hiding it so
I
well.
I am familiar with Doctor Who, however.
Oh, sweet. So I'm not the only one.
No. I know Doctor Who and the Targus and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. You know, it's good. It's a good time. But so
it is nerdy, though, I admit.
It's extremely nerdy. Yeah. I actually hated it at first because I was like, this is the dumbest nerdy crap
I've
ever seen.
I probably
but I just got into
not
it.
To cut your story off short, but I probably didn't start watching Doctor Who till like the eighth or ninth Doctor Who. Right. I was way far.
That's
gone.
About when I started.
And I'm like, hey, I watched the whole season of him.
Yeah.
And then
that,
apparently it's routine to kill him off or get rid of him. Yeah. I didn't know that.
They're like, this actor's getting old.
And he left and they replaced him with a lady Doctor Who. Nothing was wrong with the lady Doctor Who, I think. But it just, I like, that's not who Doctor Who was to me because I started.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway. So, yeah.
I actually never watched that far. Yeah. I actually stopped like halfway through. Is it Peter Capaldi?
The big guy. Yeah.
I watched a couple of his episodes and then I just lost interest in, you know.
That happens.
Life changed. But to all that to say, there was an episode. I don't remember which doctor it was.
Who can?
Someone on this will.
Yeah, who can?
But it was an episode with Van Gogh was in it.
Oh,
or
yeah.
Van Gogh as the...
Yes. I saw that episode.
Oh, sweet. So, yes, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I do.
There's that whole point where there's an underlying message in there. I think this is kind of a common story with some of those artists that we hail as, you know, masters now, who they went totally unrecognized their entire lifetime.
Van Gogh especially. Yes, absolutely.
Exactly. And he's... I know it's probably popular to say, so... he's one of my favorites. I think just for the message he has and the perspective that he brought to art, I love. Again, I'm kind of a novice with art when it comes to that medium.
Okay, fair enough. You can't go wrong for saying, hey, I like Van Gogh. He's pretty good. So,
he's pretty good.
So, you're good. You're all right there. Yeah.
It was funny. Actually, one of my friends who didn't know who he was criticized his art. He's like, oh, his perspective's all off. Like, this is terrible. I'm like, do you know like the giant you're going
it's
up
Van
against?
Van Gogh, man.
Right.
I'm going to listen to you who runs an auto repair clinic over on the 3rd and Main versus
you're
him.
Right.
Yeah, I gotcha.
Yeah, that's funny. But the one thing I love in that is like there's a huge underlying message where he's just like, what he's doing is pointless. You know, he's painting over his own artwork.
Yeah.
Everyone's like, what are you doing? Like, that's a $1 million piece right there. Million is understating it.
Yeah. Now it is. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's funny. It's like we see that and he has no idea. He's just like, this is just garbage. I'm just doing it on the side for fun. But then there's a point when they bring him to the modern day. And they bring him to his museum.
To show him all that.
And they show him like, this is your art. These are all the people that come to see your pieces. And you just see him just well up with tears.
Right.
And it goes to that legacy point. It's
of
like
making a difference, right?
Yeah, it mattered.
Yeah, it mattered.
If it didn't matter, like he thought it didn't matter, but he found out like, oh, what I'm doing actually counts. It actually means something. It's like, that means a whole lot to me. I'm getting tingles right now.
Yeah. Well,
thinking about that.
And you take that and you can also go the 180 degrees the other way, right? You know, Picasso was famous for knowing about his notoriety, like, and famously scrawling stuff on napkins to pay
yeah.
for bills
yeah.
and stuff like that. This is a drawing by Picasso. Okay. that's worth a Big Mac.
You're right.
Or whatever it is you're getting. So yeah. And you kind of, that gives you kind of an uneasy feeling, the commodification of it, but that's an economic thing. And that's a little bit of a different discussion.
Sure.
But you couldn't argue that Picasso did understand, I mean, his work, and I'm a big Picasso fan. I mean, Guernica is just a fantastic representation of man's inhumanity to man. And so there's a lot to be said for that. You know, and let's go to your era, right?
Yeah.
Or your area, music. So I'm listening to a piece by Shostakovich. I don't know anything about Shostakovich. And the orchestra director of the school where I was principal said, let me tell you about Shostakovich. He was a Russian composer who had to be careful when he was composing because of the Soviets. And
he
couldn't really say what he wanted to say in his music. So he had to be very subtle about it. He said, so if you listen, you're going to hear rockets in this. And if you listen, you're going to hear. And he just explained to me how he was being subversive in his music. Phenomenal. I'm a big Shostakovich fan, you know, now because of that.
Yeah.
Completely bare and honest with everyone listening, I love Russian artists. Russian artists make the great, great art. Music.
Yeah.
Writing. I'm a huge fan. People ask me all the time, okay, you know, you write, you read. Who's your favorite? Dostoevsky. I love Russian novels. Now, I guess it's because if your life sucks so bad, you make great art.
You know, there's something to be said for that. It's the idea of suffering.
Yeah.
And it's funny because
that's a whole other podcast.
It's
right?
True.
It is, but it,
that's like
there.
The classic artist trope is like, oh, I'm suffering. Life sucks. You know, it's like out of suffering, we can see this beauty. And I think with that, it speaks to the human condition.
Yeah. And
in a way that we don't really understand.
And it's weird to me, though. Right. I agree with you. But it's weird to me how it seems to be concentrated. Like the Russians are brilliant at it.
I mean,
their ability to communicate the.
When it gets that cold, too.
Yeah, like, no, the miseries and the joys. But I mean, yeah, you listen to their work. I mean, Tchaikovsky and all of these guys are like, whoa. It's and again, I'm a huge fan of Dostoevsky. You know, for years, every summer, I would reread Crime and Punishment. I love that novel. And it's kind of funny because if you're a reader, people are like, oh, yeah, I like Dostoevsky. Do you really? I like Charles Dickens. Do you?
Yeah.
Have you ever read Dickens or you just watched The Christmas Carol? Because
when
you read him, it's kind of like going, ugh, and you turn the page. Ugh.
Hard
to read.
I'll go and say I'm not a huge fan of Dickens.
Yeah, he's hard to read.
And part of his understanding, his background, was like, this guy was paid to write words.
Yeah.
Like, he just wrote as many words as he could because that's how much money he made.
That's right. and it's
not to say he's not good.
It's hard to read. But
yeah.
But that being said, he's a great storyteller. You know, I mean, there's a skill and there's an artisan and a craftsmanship to all of that. And, you know, storytelling. And to your point about something earlier, some are better at it than others, in fairness.
Right.
I mean, it's really big right now. This is going to go off on another tangent, but it is related to art.
Sweet.
It's really big right now. Storytelling.
Yeah.
Storytelling.
What's your story?
Storytelling in business.
Yeah.
Storytelling in the church. And,
yeah.
You know, I attend a church here locally who I really enjoy going to, and they're a large church and all this stuff, but it's all about their story and what's your story on that. And there's nothing wrong with it. Don't get me wrong. Mm-mm. But I will say this. Just because you have a story doesn't mean I'm going to read it.
True.
Right? Not everybody's stories are worthy of vast readership. I'm not saying it shouldn't be told or anything of that nature. But what I mean by it all is there is a craftsmanship. Mm-hmm. There is an artisanship to telling a story well.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Just like playing the same music, but it sounds differently.
Yeah.
There's a craftsmanship to that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's like everybody, you know, my joke on that years ago was when I was growing up, this is before UFC and all the fighting stuff, but it was just boxing. And people are like, so-and-so is boxing so-and-so, and they're getting $20 million. I'd box so-and-so for $20 million. And my response is, yeah, but I wouldn't pay $35 to see you boxing.
I don't want to see you box.
Right. There's the element of value for what we're getting.
Yeah.
And I know that's, again, a different thing to come out related to art, but I do think it speaks a little bit to, it's like How many times have you been somewhere, Paul, either on the computer or with someone, maybe even in the gallery, where there's an abstract, specifically, it's usually abstract, and someone says, oh, I could have done that. And my response is, yeah, but you didn't.
Yeah.
And Jackson Pollock did.
True. Yeah.
So, I mean, there's this giving art, and it's not, maybe it's not even some of that art's not even really my thing, if you will, but I have to recognize that attention to the craftsmanship and to a vision that maybe I didn't see or don't see even.
Yeah. And that's what's funny about abstract art. It's funny because I've definitely been one to make fun of it at times. But it is funny. It's like the idea of who's doing it and who's not doing it. But also, there's abstract art that I absolutely love.
Yeah.
Because it's like, it speaks to me in a way that other art hasn't. There's other pieces, it's like, I don't care.
One of my favorites is any work by Mark Rothko. Have you ever seen Rothko's work? It's a lot of
colors.
Sounds
familiar.
It's color. Some of it is like, it's titled like Red on Black. Mm. And it's this red-black rectangle. And I don't know why, but it's amazing, especially when you see it in person. And it's this 6-foot by 4-foot red on black thing. And it's an amazing, and to your point, I don't know why it speaks.
Yeah.
But it does.
Yeah.
In an interesting way. Alexander Calder's mobiles, he has these hanging things or like that. They're abstract kind of mobile things that float around with the breeze or whatever. But they're phenomenal.
Yeah.
You know, and so that, again, a whole nother digression as to why some art works, let's call it, and some doesn't.
Well, I'll even say for myself. So one of my friends back in Ohio paints a lot.
Mm-hmm.
His name's Isaiah. Isaiah, cheers to you.
Yeah.
And so he gave me a piece last year for Christmas, and I wasn't expecting it, but I was super happy to get it. And I actually have it framed in my house, and I have it up. And it's funny because when I look at it, it brings me a lot of joy.
Right.
So it's a very abstract piece. It's just lines.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, you know, layers of color on top of each other. And it goes from like a light gradient to a cooler gradient, a hot to cool kind of thing. So it's, in a lot of ways, when you look at it, it's like, oh, it's like a sunrise, or it's just a like a rainbow of colors in a sense.
Right.
And it's funny because to me, when I look at it, it brings me warmth and it makes me feel good. It's like, I love looking at this piece.
Yeah.
Like 90% of people walking to my house could care less about it.
Well, and if you ask, so that's, and here's what I love about art. So you ask your friend Isaiah, what is this? What did you were trying to do? And he says, oh, I was trying to blah, 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 blah.
Right.
And he looks at you and goes, what does it mean to you? And you go, oh, well, to me, it's just about blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
And someone else comes in your home and go, huh, that's just a thing about blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And nobody's wrong.
It's true.
I mean, technically, somebody's wrong.
Technically,
right? I mean,
the artist's interpretation is the correct one.
Right,
but
right. But in terms of writing, there's a famous line where, as a writer, when you let the book go, you're gone. It doesn't matter what you thought or you tried to do.
Yeah.
What the audience does with it is what the audience, the reader, whatever, does with it, right? And, oh, I meant to do that. Sorry, that's not how it works.
What we got.
Yeah. I mean, and so, my son likes to give me a hard time because I taught him growing up, you know, about jokes, right? If I got to explain it to you, it ain't funny. And so in terms of art, you know, they're like, oh, this is what I meant to. Nope, sorry. Right. You don't get to explain it.
We didn't get that.
Yeah, it is what it is.
And that's huge to say for communication.
Yeah.
That, where it's like there is, and it's funny because this relates to God in a huge way.
Right.
Where it's like you have this divine knowledge, this perfect communicator, going through these very bad transmitters.
Yes.
And I'm pointing at myself for anyone not knowing.
Right.
Anyone listening. And it's like, yeah, there's a breakdown in communication that happens there. And that can happen with art too. You can have this person who's been divinely inspired to create this piece of art, but then it has to go through this funnel of poor transmitters, poor receivers, I'll say.
Good point. Yeah.
And we receive it differently sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, and it's interesting too about how, you know, that trust level that both that God has with us, that he doesn't have to have. I mean, there's an old kind of apocryphal story about how Jesus is up in heaven and he's talking with the angels, or God's talking with, I'm sorry about it. And he's like, okay, here's the story. I'm sending Jesus. This is what's going to happen. And the angels are like, well, I don't know. You know, you mean that when he comes back, that the people are going to tell them what's plan B? And God famously says, there is no plan B. Right. This is how I'm choosing to spread the gospel. That's a lot of trust. And I think bringing it to art, right? You let it go and you trust that it gets there, but it may not.
Yeah.
And you know, for me, it's not that I don't appreciate abstract work, you know, visual work, even there is some, I've read some funky, bizarre fiction. I'm a big fiction fan. And I get to the end of it. My wife said, what's that about? And I go, honey, I cannot tell you what this was about that I just spent 2 days reading. But I tend to gravitate toward things that are a little less ephemeral, if I can use that phrase. One of my favorite poets is the poet Billy Collins, great poet. And I like him so much because he takes things that are everyday type things and he translates them in an artistic way that just works. So for a quick example, he has a poem about a barking dog that keeps him up at night. And the name, and you have to read it, but the name of the poem is Another Reason I Don't Keep a Gun in the House. it's like, okay, I get that.
Yeah.
And I'm a big fan, by the way, of a photographer here in Florida, Clyde Butcher. And Clyde is famous for his massive, and when I say massive ball, I mean like 6 feet by 8 feet photographic prints. He shoots on a large format, and it's of Florida's natural wonder. And the thing that resonates with me, I own a couple of his prints, none of them quite that big, but I own a couple of his prints. When you go to his gallery, it's just mind-blowing. They're just massive. Wow. But the cool thing is for me is he has made a landscape that I'm familiar with, Florida. Various parts of Florida, the Panhandle and all, you know, the Everglades, all of, but he's made it, he's given an artistic representation to it. He's made art out of stuff that was everyday.
Wow.
And that's a really kind of cool thing. Billy Collins does that with his poetry. He makes art out of things that are everyday. I tend personally to gravitate toward that more so than the abstract or the ephemeral or the hard to understand stuff. Yeah. I can work at it. I mean, like I said, I love Russian novelists. If you like Russian novelists, you can work. I mean, I work through them, but it's hard to understand. It's an exercise to do that sort of thing.
Wow. You reminded me, especially with the local artist. When I was in London at the museum there, they have,
Well, you got to be more specific than that. Which museum?
The Museum of Art they have. They got a lot of museums.
that one Museum of Art they have.
You know, the museum they have there.
The National Gallery.
So it's the National Gallery.
Yeah, it isn't that, but just say that.
Yeah, it's, you know.
It's the National Gallery.
If you go and you type in art museum in London, it's this one will pop up. Yeah. And the great thing I love about this, they're all free.
They are. Yeah.
Which I love. Yeah. Like that. I love the idea of that.
Absolutely cool.
Because it just opens it up to people.
Right.
Which is great. But the one thing I love there is they have a lot of great painting, a lot of great art, and one of which is Monet's painting of one of the lily pads.
One of the lilies, yeah.
And it's funny because I've always seen this in, you know, on my computer, in
magazines,
magazines.
Yeah.
And it's just like, there it is.
Yeah.
Cool. Sounds good. I get it.
Yeah.
I see it in real life. It's the size of the wall.
Yeah.
And like you said about Clyde Butcher, it's like, this painting is massive.
Yeah.
And what it really said to me, which is funny because like, I've seen it so much. Personally, it's like it doesn't really do that much to me. But seeing in person did a lot.
Absolutely.
And what it did was, standing close, it's just blobs of paint. Like one lily pad is the size of a normal painting.
Yeah, it's huge.
And it's like, it's massive. And then I stand back and I see it from a different perspective. And what it speaks to me, which is the way we see art and how it reaches people differently, is that's why God asked you to preach the gospel. That's why God asked me to preach the gospel. And he asked Trey or whoever else it is. Because you're going to reach people I can't. I'm going to reach people you can't. And whoever else is going to in a different way. Because art speaks to us differently. It grabs our attention differently. People grab our attention differently. People that turn us off, another person might, you know, get us to pay attention.
Yeah. And I think your concept of perspective is so key. You know, not that this podcast here, this episode is specifically about this, but I think a really key element of the Gospels is perspective.
Yeah.
I strongly believe Jesus's major emphasis was to get us to see things, as I said, with a different set of eyes. I think that's what the parable of the Good Samaritan's about.
Yeah.
I think over and over again, you know, I mean, a perfect example is when, you know, he had these conversations with the disciples about the rich and the wealthy, and he told this parable about the rich and the disciples, what'd they say? who then can be saved? Mm. They didn't even understand. They thought that was a wealthy thing. And Jesus is like, no, let me explain this to you. So that he's trying to get this shift their perspective. And here's the thing that resonates with me about that, Paul. However, 22,000 years ago, whatever that is, right? It's still the same today.
Yeah.
People don't get it. People's perspective. And I don't mean, I mean, I know there's a danger in, as we started off the beginning of the show, about anarchic freedom of expression, right? Mm. Anything goes. I realize that. I think we're a long way from that, though.
Yeah.
I think we actually have come back to the limiting things in our social factors and our political factors and our, why isn't it okay to think that Trump may have done something good? Why isn't it okay to say Trump really screwed the pooch on this particular thing? He messed this thing up.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It should be okay to have those same views. Right.
Yeah.
And yet it's not. You're right. That's the whole polarization thing. And while not getting political, you could take that into any sphere you want.
Yeah.
And I think the key to not feeling that way is perspective. It's just learning to see things. And I really believe, as we've talked a lot about today already, that art has a way of doing that, of getting in music and so forth. Really.
Yeah.
Has us, lets us see and hear and think and feel things differently, even though it's the same thing. Right.
And I just thought of it now, which is funny that it's taken me this long to make this connection, but it's like, we look at how did Jesus speak to the people that we see in the Gospels? People didn't ask, like, who's my neighbor? He didn't say, well, your neighbor is everyone. He said, all right, there's a Samaritan going down the road.
He told a story.
And it's like, because there's a level of transcendence to that, that he's opening it up to a way you wouldn't be receptive to another way.
There's a, I don't know if you're familiar with the Christian artist, Michael Card.
Musician, I don't think
so. Musician, really, really good. Michael Card has a book out about Christians and art and so forth. And it's an older book, but he starts off with the whole image of Jesus in that story of the woman who's caught in adultery. And he's focusing on the scene in which, you know, the Pharisees, and I love to play these movies in my head. I don't know if you do this. I've seen this.
Oh, yeah.
The Pharisees have got him, right? They got him. This woman's in adultery. Never mind the man that should have also been there, okay?
Because, sure.
But they've got this woman. She's in adultery. It's an open and shut case. And they turn to this rebel Jesus teacher guy and they say, hey, what are we going to do?
Yeah.
Because if you say not to kill her, you're violating your own law.
Yeah.
And if you say to kill her, okay, but how's that going to look from a PR perspective, right?
It's like, hey, Jesus, here's this bull. Good luck.
Yeah.
Here's his horns.
go ahead.
Yeah.
And Jesus brilliantly doesn't do either of those.
Yeah.
He says, you know, you're right, kill her. Oh, by the way, anybody who hasn't sinned, you throw first.
Yeah.
And then they're like, in my mind, I play this and they're like, tossing the stone. Okay, I'm going to go back to bed. I'm done.
Like,
I'm done here. But Michael Card in his book focuses on a part of that that often gets overlooked. And you may recall there's a point in that story, in that scene, where Jesus reaches down for minutes. They don't know how long, but minutes. And he just starts scribbling in the sand.
Yeah.
And commentators forever have debated what was he doing? Was he writing something? Was he drawing something?
Yeah.
And Michael Card makes the point that whatever he was doing, he was creating. He was creating something and he was giving time for the people to cool off. And then he was going to give this, he was going to drop the bomb on him, which he did. And so,
yeah.
But it's an interesting story that relates to even Jesus's creative, right? Things about whether he's drawing in the sand, who knows what he's doing, but the stories that he told, because that was all a part of, as you said earlier, communication.
Yeah.
Right. And we remember things that way, you know, songs and stories. You know, that's why earlier, you know, Mako Fujimura said God spoke to us first as an artist and then as a lecturer, because you remember the art.
Yeah.
You remember how that made you feel.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. Are we about done here? I don't know how long we're going on.
I actually just looked. I'm like, oh, man, we've gone for like over an hour now. And that's usually our time right there.
Yeah.
Well, so thank you.
I didn't know if I was going to end up on the hour show or the 20-minute show. Yeah.
Oh, no.
Or how you guys do that.
Like, you made us wait this long. You're on the hour.
Yeah, I didn't know. Like, he stunk. Just put him on the 20-minute show. Just put him
can
on
we edit it down to like 4 seconds?
4 seconds, yeah. Just let us tell him his name and then be done with him.
And we'll cut the episode.
We'll cut the episode. So.
But yeah, thank you so much for being on and sharing and being open.
Yeah, it's a great experience. I love what you're doing. Can I do a shameless plug?
Oh, of course.
So
I was going to ask you.
Yeah, I'm working on some of my own creative work, specifically a newsletter. I hesitate to call it a blog, but it's called Possible Things.
Okay.
And it's not specifically spiritual, but the name comes from the verse that says with man, these things are impossible, but with God, all things are possible.
Hmm.
So I'm curious as to what are these possible things that we can do creatively, inspiringly. So I'm working on that as kind of, again, a newsletter and maybe a podcast where I talk to people and I write about these things that make us whole, that make us better. Because I think there's a lot of tearing down that we do right now. And these are just things about, and I'm not saying it's going to be this namby-pamby Barney the Dinosaur show, right? You know, but I am working on that. I hope the listeners maybe I'll have one of you guys on that show where we just talk about what it means to be inspiring and to be creative and what that looks like. So I am working on that. So
that's awesome. Yeah, we'll definitely have a link in the description for that for people to check that out.
Sure.
If you have one, or
I will have one by the time the show's ready.
I think we're about 3 to 4 weeks out.
Okay. So. All right. Wow.
So okay, we've got plenty of time to make it work. But yeah, thank you so much. Yeah. I appreciate the plug.
Sorry Trey couldn't be here. Hopefully it was meaningful to him.
I hope so.
Yeah, hopefully you make him listen to the shows he's not on.
Trey, you better listen.
I don't care about just sticking master's classes. You figure this out. Yeah.
What, you got other stuff to do?
Yeah, I know. My daughter's taking her master's program and I'm going to make her listen. So
if she has time, you have time,
that's
Trey.
That's right.
But yeah, thank you so much for being on.
Awesome,
you know, it was totally worth the wait. I'd love to have you on again with Trey.
I brought booze. So it's true. That.
This is the best. He brought gifts.
Yeah, I'm going to leave the photograph. Hopefully, we're going to post some maybe on the Instagram so the viewer can see it.
I'd love to.
But I'm going to leave a photographer. I'm going to leave. You get to choose because Annie had to leave.
Ooh.
Which one would you like?
So I love the black and white one.
I
think you knew where I was going with
that. Well, I have to say, I had about 30 pictures that I called keepers of the photographer of the Utah trip.
Mm.
And this is at the top two or three.
That's so cool.
A good one too. The arch is good.
I love that. Yeah.
But Canyon Awe just captures all of us would feel when we.
Yeah.
And I actually came up through that and probably did the same thing this lady's doing. I don't remember, but I'm like, look up. Like, oh my.
Wow.
So this is your gift for
having me on. Thank you.
So
no, I
put that right up next to Isaiah's print, please.
Oh, I will.
And take a picture and show.
I'll send it to you. I'm going to post it online so you guys can see it too.
Yeah.
I love this picture. Thank you for sharing this with me.
Appreciate it. I'm glad to do it.
So art's amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing. Yeah.
And yeah, thanks for being open and speaking about that. And what I will say in closing here, there's a whole lot to say.
Yeah.
But what I would love to end on is, you know, there's so much uncertainty in life. There's so much uncertainty in just day-to-day life and whatever we go through. But the truth of the matter is, and I come back to this, I've said it already today, I'm saying it again because I just can't see any way around it. Truth is truth is truth, and right. Christ is truth.
Yeah.
And when we fix our eyes on that, when that is our goal, that is our system, if we create a system in life to always point ourselves to who Christ is, we're gonna end up in a good place eventually. It's gonna take us a while.
Right. And everybody's journey will be different in terms of
exactly.
It'll be, you know, some are more, let me put it this way, some are more crooked than others, right? But yes, I would agree with you, Paul. I think that's an excellent way to say it.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, and you know, there's gonna be small things that as Christians we disagree on.
Right.
There's gonna be large things that we disagree on, and that's gonna have different consequences to it. But it's important for us to know that we're on this journey, show grace to others who are in a different place, and share truth and love with those that you perceive are not in the right place.
Right. And I would add to that, great, great points. Be humble about your truth.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Because sometimes the things you thought were true years ago, you find out aren't. And you want to make sure.
Yeah.
So there's a humility. I think even Jesus was such the epitome of humility. And
Yeah.
he didn't consider himself God, even though he was God. He humbled him, right? The whole thing about humility. And again, another topic for another podcast. But
it's
true.
But I love that. And I think that's one thing I'll say, even looking at Christ, is when we see Jesus, where were the moments that he flipped tables over? That's when they made a mockery of who God was.
Right. The only time.
Yeah.
Right.
When we see other points where people had questions, people lived differently, but it wasn't necessarily a mockery of God. He showed grace and love to those
people. How patient was he? I used to say forever.
Oh my goodness.
I used to say forever. When I taught various Bible studies about, and I used to say this, I used to say, you know, the disciples, if I was walking around with God as they were, I would not ask such stupid questions. And then God kind of taps me on the shoulders and he says, you are walking around with me and you do ask stupid questions. So I, you're right. It's about humility and I think it comes to this. This is one of my truly favorite scenes in the gospel. Jesus has just finished what many of our Bibles call the hard teachings, you know, about divorce. And he talked about the flesh of my flesh. And people are like, whoa, you got to eat people. I mean, everybody was freaking him out.
Yeah.
And people, and it says, the scripture says, people are leaving him. Their disciples are like, oh, we got it. And he looks at his disciples and he says, are you going to leave too? And I believe it was Peter looks and says, where would we go?
Yeah.
Where else would we go?
Yeah.
Right. No matter how crazy all this seems, you are the truth. And so I always come back to that, and how nuts it gets. Where else am I going to go?
Yeah.
Right. He is the savior. So.
Yeah. I'm not going to say anything more than that. Yeah. I love that. That's a great place to end. Thank you so much to Maximize Digital Media and Annie Uli for producing this episode. Daryl, thank you for being on.
Happy to be here. Happy to stare at Chris Sandlong's lovely face the entire show. Yes.
She's right here on our screen, staring back. Thank you guys for listening. It's been a great journey we've been on through this podcast as we've grown and learned. And I look forward to continuing growing and learning with all of you.
Yep. Thanks for having me.
We'll catch you next time.